Dr. Brett, just a few more questions on the adult monkey study. And in fact, just on one of them, the Exhibit 116, which is the changes in the number of astrocytes paper. You several times described this group of studies as a high-dose methylmercury study. If we start on Scott's the second page of this paper, in the left-hand column, and the first full paragraph, they're referring, when they say the above examples, there's a long list of citations of the previous studies on monkeys where neurotoxicity had been demonstrated in the brain. And what they say here is the above examples of methylmercury-induced damage in the primate brain have been demonstrated following relatively high doses of methylmercury exposure. And these exposures usually result in the development of behavioral symptoms. In general, subclinical levels of methylmercury exposure have not received as much attention in experimental models, and this is particularly true for research carried out in primates. And what I want to ask you is, don't you agree that the whole design of this study that resulted in these five papers was to test the lowest dose yet on adult primate, on adult monkeys?
I don't know what their motivation is for doing the study, but let me comment on these points. They were looking at a model that they described as they wanted to be subclinical. In other words, effects, in other words, without any clinical effects. Or if so, they were minor clinical effects. And that's what they achieved in this study. These monkeys were behaviorally fine. They did not have any clinical abnormalities that anybody could see. But nevertheless, the dose that they used was 50 micrograms per kilogram of body weight per day. That translates into a 70-kilogram person of 3,500 micrograms a day. Remembering that for the general population, our yearly intake of methylmercury is about 11,000 micrograms. So in 3 days, these animals had what the average person would have in a year, and they just did it continuously. So yes, it was subclinical in the sense that there were no effects observed, but certainly the doses used in these studies bear no relevance whatsoever to the doses used, for example, in a thimerosal-containing vaccine, and in fact bear no relevance whatsoever to the amount of methylmercury that we all get from our normal fish eating and chicken eating every day. So, and that's why I called it a high-dose study.
And then on page 135, which is, again, I can't see the exhibit page, but it's the next to last page of text of the study. And I'll tell you the exhibit page when we find it. Okay. What page of the exhibit is this, Scott? Can you tell?
Page 9
of the of exhibit 116. In the right hand column, about three sentences up from the bottom of the where in the middle of what you have highlighted there, Scott, they characterize this. They say the continued accumulation of inorganic mercury over time within the brain following chronic low-level exposure to methylmercury may prove to be the proximate toxic form associated with this type of exposure scenario. So at least these investigators were characterizing this as a low-dose study. I know you disagree with the way they characterize it.
Would you like me to testify that 3,500 micrograms a day of methylmercury is a low-dose exposure? I cannot do that.
Now, if we go to, again, in the same study, the previous page, Scott, which then is page 134 of the study, in the left-hand column, just above the word microglia, in bold there, it says that widespread loss of astrocytes can be expected to disrupt the composite ability of the astrocytes to carry out their supporting function for neurons, and ultimately their loss would be expected to impact the overall function of the central nervous system. However, at the exposure dose and duration used in this study, the loss of astrocytes has not resulted in the loss of neurons within the thalamus. Excuse me, the loss of astrocytes has not resulted in the loss of neurons within the thalamus. Do you agree that eventually widespread loss of astrocytes could affect neuronal function?
Well, I think if you gave so much mercury or so much of any other potential substance that can affect astrocytes, obviously much more than they gave in this study, you can ultimately get to the point where you would cause some neurotoxicity. I think that's the basic principle of dose response. You can certainly get there if you give enough. However, it should be pointed out, in this study, there really wasn't much loss of astrocytes. And so they're just talking about what might happen if the doses were even greater to the point where you might see that. It's kind of, once again, we're in the discussion and the speculative part of the paper. This is not the data from the paper.
Now, if you'll turn to back to the page 135, the page we were on originally, on the left-hand column, just under where it says potential toxic role of inorganic mercury. If you'll yes, that's what I want. It says the microglia population is a responsive cell type. Once damage has been repaired following activation after injury, microglia are known to return to a quiescent state. However, the number of activated microglia remained elevated, and we go to the next column, in the monkeys of the clearance group, which were kept unexposed for 6 months following 12 months of methylmercury exposure. This group had very low concentrations of methylmercury but retained elevated concentrations of inorganic mercury at levels comparable to the 12-month exposure group. And this suggests that inorganic mercury may be the proximate species of mercury responsible for microglia activation, a situation similar to that proposed for the cortex study we already looked at. Now, do you agree that normally microglia, they have a protective role? They come in, they clean up whatever's there, and then they return to their quiescent state?
To the extent that I understand microglia, which is limited, that I would say yes.
And if they stay activated, then they can become toxic to neurons or astrocytes.
Once again, my understanding of microglia is more limited than other people who are going to be testifying later, so I'm going to have to limit the scope of my answer here. My understanding is that microglial activation is not necessarily a bad thing, and that the effects here are not necessarily indicative of any neuropathology. But once again, you know, remember we're talking about inorganic mercury effects at the concentrations that they give here, and if the inorganic mercury is causing adverse effects, then it's the seafood and the chicken people are eating and not the vaccines, because that's where the far greater exposure comes from. And that doesn't make any sense, because everybody's eating seafood and chicken, including children who are getting it via breast milk, getting the methylmercury being by breast milk. And we don't think of breast milk as a neurotoxin.
If we go down the column in the same page to about four sentences above the dark, about where you have it highlighted, where it says further loss of astrocytes. It says further loss of astrocytes would be expected to have deleterious effects on the neuron population, for example, through an excitotoxic mechanism. you were here when Dr. Kinsborn testified that that was his
hypothesis,
his understanding of the mechanism that could likely be at work here, that you would have astrocytes no longer able to take up glutamate, so you have an excess of glutamate and have neurons get overexcited, right?
Well, once again, you know, you're getting a little bit out of the mercury area, so my answer here is going to be quite limited. What I took away from Dr. Kinsborn's testimony was that he was hypothesizing that there was an excitotoxic mechanism related to astrocyte effect. But here, for example, it says further loss of astrocytes. In this study, there really wasn't even that much loss of astrocytes. And certainly, we talked about the exposure scenario, right. I won't bring that up.
Right. And although you want to talk about the methylmercury dose here, you recall that the authors of the infant monkey study made a point of saying that the levels of inorganic mercury in the brains of these adult monkeys was only 5 times higher on average than the levels they found in those infant monkey brains, right?
That's right. And I think that's very good evidence, therefore, that the inorganic mercury is not acting as a neurotoxin, or else we're being poisoned every day. And we're having autism being formed every day from breast milk, from seafood, from chicken.
And then a sentence we haven't read yet, just after it says exposure scenario, I'd read that one. It says, this form of long-term toxic response may be mechanistically different than the focal damage associated with acute high levels exposure to methylmercury. You understand that, in other words, in classic methylmercury high dose toxicity, you get lesions in particular parts of the brain, don't you?
You do.
Some of those are probably from edema causing extra pressure, and the fissures fold, and you get focal damage in the fissures of the brain, right?
Well, there's lots of different reasons.
But here, what they saw was microglial activation in all parts of the brain they looked at. A global event.
Where do you see that, global?
Well, I'm just asking in the studies in general. They report on different
very specific parts of the brain. They looked at thalamus. They looked at calcarine cortex, which is part of the visual pathway, which is one that is particularly sensitive to mercury toxicity.
And then a final point from this paper, if we go back to page 133, three pages prior to what we were just looking at. In the section on the left-hand column under neurons and oligodendrocytes, I want to read the starting with the third sentence of that paragraph. So the third sentence of that paragraph starts, the lack of change. The authors of this study say the lack of change, increase or decrease in the number of neurons, does not mean that these cells are completely unaffected by the exposure to methylmercury. Subcellular and physiological changes are known to occur following mercury exposure. And so the cells in this study were counted by counting their nuclei, hence cells which were damaged but not killed outright would still be included by the technique employed in this study. You agree with that as a general proposition, that neurons could be dysfunctional without having been killed?
I agree that they did not detect any neuronal injury in this study. It is possible that had they looked by other techniques, they might have found some.
Right.
But at least, and that's what they're saying here, they didn't totally rule out. And certainly, that if they go to higher doses, they probably would have even seen something.
Now, earlier, I asked you...
You just finished my answer.
Sorry.
But essentially what they're saying here is, look, we didn't see any neuronal neurotoxicity. It doesn't mean we can't rule out that any may have occurred that we couldn't see. I would agree with that.
Earlier, I asked you whether the fact that they detected mercury, inorganic mercury, in neurons in this study, whether inorganic mercury in neurons at the levels detectable here, namely in, what, at least 10 parts per billion. Would you agree that
the limits of detection were?
I asked you if that was a good or bad thing, and I think you didn't answer the question. So let me ask it again. Is if you've got 10 parts per billion of inorganic mercury in your neurons, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, from the data we looked at before, we saw that you could have in your brain, it's primarily neurons, you can have in your brain 100, well in excess of 100 part per billion of mercury without any clinical effects. That study didn't specifically look at which particular cells they were in, but we know in this study, in the data that was presented here, with the neurons accumulating some amount of mercury, that there were no observed adverse effects.
But when you refer to the 100 parts per billion studies, you're talking about the studies that looked at total mercury, not inorganic mercury persisting in the brain over time.
Well, that's right, but that's what most of the mercury that persists in the brain is going to be, is inorganic mercury.
Now, the infant monkey study, if you'll recall, referred after they started talking about the inorganic mercury and what had happened in these adult monkey studies, they referred to this Vargas paper. You recall that?
Yes.
I want to just hit a couple quick high points in that Vargas paper relevant to what we've been talking about. We could pull it up. This is Petitioner's Master Reference Exhibit Number 69.
And I want to start. I don't have a copy of the Vargas paper here.
Oh, sorry.
For the record, I don't believe the Vargas papers were discussed by
all. Right, and you're objecting based on what?
I'm not sure. I guess I would like to see where the next question is going to go to mercury in a toxicological question as opposed to a neurological question.
Let's hear the question, and then we'll decide. Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
First, I do believe he discussed the Vargas paper in direct, and it's cited in the infant monkey study as a relevant study. And part of what I'm trying to establish is that he didn't examine all the relevant literature as he claimed. But nevertheless, let me see if I can make this relevant even to you. Let me ask it this way. Do you agree that it's part of a neurotoxicologist's job to determine whether or not an agent could provoke neuroinflammation?
Sure.
Okay. Let's look at the abstract, just the last half of the abstract. Scott, if you can blow that up and highlight it a little bit. It says, we demonstrate an active neuroinflammatory process in the cerebral cortex, white matter, and notably in cerebellum of autistic patients. And they talk about some of the biomarkers they found. And they say, our findings indicate that innate neuroimmune reactions play a pathogenic role in an undefined proportion of autistic patients, suggesting that future therapies might involve modifying neuroglial responses in the brain. Now,
Mr. Williams, I need to understand kind of where you're going with here, because I don't find Vargas cited in the infant monkey study. Oh, in Burbacher. At least, unless I'm spelling it wrong. I was just trying to put myself wherever the witness was. Vader, but I don't find Vargas.
If you look, Special Master, at page 6 of the infant monkey study,
okay,
this is exhibit 26, page 6, there's this long discussion of the adult monkey studies in the right-hand column. At the very end of that column, or paragraph, they say, it is important to note that an active neuroinflammatory process has been demonstrated in the brains of autistic patients including the marked activation of microglia, Vargas et al.
Okay. It's just not coming up when I do a search. All right, thank you.
Then what I'd suggest, Your Honor, is that the question be limited to the discussion of Vargas in the Burbacher paper, well, rather than to a discussion of Vargas itself, which in the highlighted part I see nothing that discusses mercury at all. The question
posed, I understand your objection such as it is, and if Dr. Brent can answer, he can answer, and if he can't, I'm sure he'll tell us that it's outside his area of expertise.
Thank you.
So go ahead.
With all due respect to Mr. Madanowski, I don't believe he was in.
I ruled.
I'm sorry.
Just move on, Mr. Williams, please.
I read the sentence that said our findings indicate that innate neuroimmune reactions play a pathogenic role here. One of your slides seemed to criticize the petitioners here for having one theory in the Cedillo case about stimulating the immune system and a theory here, or excuse me, about suppressing the immune system and a theory about stimulating the immune system. But isn't there a big difference between the adaptive immune system and the innate immune system that is implicated in this paper?
Well, let me answer it this way. First of all, let me clear up a misconception of something you said. I did not refer to the Vargas paper on my direct testimony. Secondly, I have read the Vargas paper, and I can tell you the word mercury exists nowhere in this paper. Thirdly, whether you're talking about the adaptive or the innate immune system, you're basically talking about some component of the immune system being stimulated.
You do agree that in the Cedillo case, the focus of the thimerosal damage to the immune system was on the adaptive immune system, correct? The ability to kill viruses.
If you read my cross-examination by Ms. Jin Kaplan, in the Cedillo case, you will find that she cited multiple high-dose studies dealing with different aspects of the immune system and the immunological response.
If we turn to page 12 of this Vargas paper, in the left-hand column at the very bottom, I'm going to agree with you that it doesn't mention the word mercury. However, it says that one alternative explanation of this inflammatory process is that extrinsic causative factors, for example, non-genetic, neurotoxic, or environmental, involved in the pathogenesis of autism, may produce neuronal and cortical abnormalities to which neuroglial reactions are only secondary responses. Do you see that?
You read that correctly.
And again, is it your opinion and your expertise in neurotoxicology that an agent that could ignite the neural inflammatory process as described in this autopsy study of autistic people, any neurotoxin, whether it's mercury or a virus that could ignite that process, should be on the list of potential etiological factors for autism?
When you say on the list of potential, you mean on the list of factors that might cause autism? The list of factors that might be investigated as a potential cause of autism? I'm not sure I understand your question.
My question is, do you agree with a statement, it's made in several of these papers, that an agent that can provoke a neural inflammatory reaction is a suspect for causing autism?
You know, I would have to say, As a medical toxicologist, that is a question that would be best directed to a neuroscientist.
Have you looked at the terbutaline situation? Terbutaline is a toxin, correct?
Terbutaline is an FDA-approved drug. Like any drug, depending upon dose and so on, it may have adverse effects.
My question is, did you, when you were doing your thorough and careful review of all the relevant literature, did you look at the terbutaline model of provoking both autism and neuroinflammatory responses?
Not really. I looked briefly at some of the epi. It did not seem relevant to anything I was discussing. I did not include that in my report. It was not something in my discussion. I did look briefly at it. I've heard much discussion of it here. I will tell you, in my opinion, from only what I've looked at briefly, I think the discussion is a bit overblown with regard to the degree of association and whether such an association actually exists. But other than that, no, I cannot say anything more about terbutaline.
Well, you say it's overblown. Let me just quickly make a couple points here, and then we'll move off this topic. But if we look at the Connors paper, which is petitioner's exhibit 73,
I don't have that.
I need a copy for him. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're really referring to petitioner's master list, because there may be a different number for petitioner's exhibit.
I'm sorry. Petitioner's master reference list 73, page 1. I just want to show the title and the authors here. Do you see that this is a group from Johns Hopkins, including Dr. Andrew Zimmerman, mm-hmm. as well as Dr. Connors?
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with this group of researchers, aren't you?
I know Dr. Zimmerman.
And just to show you the point of the paper, if you blow up that abstract, Scott, it says that continuous terbutaline exposure for 2 weeks or longer was associated with an increased concordance for autism spectrum disorders in dizygotic twins and a further increase in the risk for male twins with no other affected siblings. Now, don't you agree that that's evidence that terbutaline may be causing autism in some children?
That is evidence of an association in one particular paper. I'm not even sure I see a statistical analysis of that. Let's see, here it is. Oh, no, that deals with the polymorphisms. That by itself would, to me, certainly raise the question that there might be something there. But as I said before, when you look at the when you have to look at the totality of data, you can't simply look at one association study. As a matter of fact, if you look at the relative, the p-value, as I see here in Table 2, it's a non-significant p-value. It's a non-significant association for the total group. The if you look down on the bottom, on that one particular group, no ASD SIBs or male-female sets, the relative risk of 4.4, that's the one positive p-value. Based on that, I don't think you can make a global conclusion, a global causation conclusion. It's a bit of data. It's a bit of data that, you know, certainly warrants further looking at, but I don't think you can conclude definitively that terbutaline causes this. There are many two associations that don't actually involve causal relationships.
So if a physician was trying to run through the possible causes of autism in a child, you wouldn't consider putting terbutaline on the list of possible agents?
If somebody said to me, I have an autistic child in my practice, and that child received terbutaline prenatally, is that likely to have been a contributor? I would say the jury's out. There is some data that it might be, but we don't know for sure yet.
Now, in fact, this group has done a little bit more research on this. And just briefly again, if we pull up petitioner's master reference list number 106, which is the Zarate paper. I need a copy for witness.
Thank you.
Now, the title of this paper is Neuroinflammation and Behavioral Abnormalities After Neonatal Terbutaline Treatment in Rats, Implications for Autism. And again, the authors here, Zarate is the first author, but we have Connors, Vargas, Zimmerman, and Pardo. That's again, this highly respected group at Johns Hopkins, right?
Yes.
And just to show the abstract, Scott, and the conclusions. I don't want to bother with that. Let's go over to the other side. It says, our findings indicate that overstimulation of these receptors during an early critical period results in microglial activation associated with innate neuroinflammatory pathways and behavioral abnormalities similar to those described in autism. Correct?
That's what it says.
So these authors, these investigators at Johns Hopkins, have not only found an association between terbutaline exposure and autism, in an animal model, they've found that it appears to be a neuroinflammatory process.
They have not said that this data shows that terbutaline causes autism. I haven't seen anybody make that kind of statement. This is an area of active research. I think people are looking at it. There is some there is some data out there that is people are looking at. But I haven't seen any definitive statement by anybody. I haven't seen any definitive study on this topic. All I can say is, you know, it's out there. It's one of the many things that's under investigation in medicine. There may be something to it. It may not when everything shakes out.
Now, I just want to review the papers we've gone through and ask you a question about each one. The first one is the Burbacher Clarkson infant monkey study, published in 05. It was discussed and cited in your report, as well as in our reports back in August of 07. And my question is, do you agree that that's a relevant paper for the special masters to consider?
It is.
Okay. The next one was the five papers on the adult monkey studies. Those were not cited or discussed in your report, although they were in our reports back in August. Do you agree that those are relevant studies?
Well, let me point out a couple of things about that. I mentioned on a number of occasions why I found those studies uninformative about the question of whether thimerosal-containing vaccines contribute to autism. Those studies provide no information about that, nothing useful that can be used for that. You may consider that I'm a medical toxicologist. My role here is to comment on the theories put forth and the hypothesis put forth by Dr. Potion. Dr. Potion didn't discuss this paper.
Do you think that this is a relevant paper for the special masters to consider or not?
I will say again, this paper, I see no way that this paper can be informative to anybody about the question of whether thimerosal-containing vaccines induce autism. The paper is not even about autism. And if, in matter of fact, if one were to try to take away from these papers that inorganic mercury somehow is related to autism, then you have to look at where our major exposure to inorganic mercury is. And our major exposure to inorganic mercury is methylmercury through food and through breastfeeding.
You have said that several times. My question is, do you think this is relevant or not?
I was just trying to explain to you why I felt this was not a relevant paper.
Okay. The Vargas paper that talks about neurotoxins as a possible cause of the neuroinflammatory process is seen in autism. Is that a relevant paper?
I will point out to you that whether it is or is not a relevant paper, I cannot comment on because it did not deal with mercury. That's what I'm here to discuss. It was not a toxicology paper. You better, in terms of any mercury-related issues, no, I find it irrelevant. In terms of other issues here, related to these proceedings, I can't comment. It may or may not be.
So you don't know? Is that a fair way to put characterize it?
I'm telling you that it has nothing to do with the issue of mercury and thimerosal-containing vaccines. Whether it has to do with other issues that come up in this proceedings, I cannot comment on.
Okay. Pardo autism review paper, you probably feel the same way about that?
Did not mention mercury. It's not a mercury-related paper. I just really don't want to be offering opinions that are far outside of my area. Knowing myself, if I did, I would probably say something wrong that was incorrect.
So it would be fair for us to put in here irrelevant from a toxicologist point of view. Is that?
Yes.
That would be the right answer. I mean,
for the Vargas paper?
The Vargas paper and the Pardo review of the Vargas paper.
From a toxicology point of view, yes. That is outside of my area of interest.
Okay.
Of expertise.
Right. And then the Korchesny review, which I didn't show you here to save time, but that's the one that talks about anything that can ignite this neuroinflammatory process.
Korchesny review is not about mercury. I specifically said in discussing Dr. Aposhin's six pillars that I was only going to address five of them. One of them was Korchesny, which was not a toxicology paper, and I was not going to address it.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. And then the Connors and Zercati studies on terbutaline and its neuroinflammatory properties.
My testimony here dealt with mercury and thimerosal containing vaccines, not with terbutaline.
Let me ask you this. Do you agree that there are some identified postnatal agent exposures that can cause autism?
That would be best asked of an autism expert. That would be best asked to an autism expert.
Okay. On page 27 of your report, and we can get it out if I think you'll agree that the statement's there, you say that thimerosal-containing vaccines do not cause accumulation of mercury in infants. Now,
can you show me where that is?
Sure, let's pull that up if we can, Scott. And I'll identify it by exhibit number. Oops, what was it, Scott? It was on the screen a second.
G.
I
got a copy of the report.
Respondents exhibit G. Page 27.
Okay. Page 27. And okay, please go ahead.
I may have written it down incorrectly. Oh no, it's there. In the middle paragraph of page 27, it says, therefore, because the ethyl mercury from episodic vaccinations is rapidly eliminated, the exposure is not continuous, nor is it cumulative. Right in the middle of the page.
Right.
Now, based on our review of the Burbacher infant monkey study and the adult monkey studies, do you agree now that that's an incorrect statement?
Not really. I mean, you could talk about the fact that whenever you get a vaccination, most of the mercury is eliminated. You get a small amount that remains in the brain, but it is so it is so minuscule compared to the brain concentrations of mercury that you really don't get any significant bioaccumulation from it.
Just a couple more points. You mentioned the Easter case where the the child was unsuccessful in federal court. You actually testified at the hearing in that case, didn't you?
No.
Just by deposition?
That's right.
You do know that Judge Ward specifically said he was not ruling on general causation. It was only a specific causation question. You admit, you agree with that?
I remember that particular language.
And that he also told the child and the child's parents that when they had stronger evidence, they could come back. He didn't dismiss the case forever.
I don't recall that, but I'll accept your interpretation.
Then the final question is this. We know that the Burbacher group is looking at the pathology of those infant monkey brains to see if they find the same neuroinflammatory processes in the adult monkeys, or what else they find. Do you think it's appropriate for you or for the scientific community in general to close the door on the question of whether thimerosal can cause autism before we know the results of that study?
You know, I would have to say this. There's always people doing more studies on more things. If somebody has funding to do a study, they're going to do the study. At this point, my position is very much the same as the IOM, all the rest of these organizations, that resources would be better spent other places, that there is an overwhelming body of evidence that thimerosal-containing vaccines are not associated with autism. People will continue to do studies from time to time. I don't think you can say that one should not take a position on what the huge body of medical literature says based on waiting for one particular study to be published.
I don't want to let you escape with the word autism versus regressive autism, so let me put the question to you again.
If
the special masters are considering the question of whether thimerosal leading to inorganic mercury in the brain, leading to neuroinflammation, can cause autistic symptoms, do you think that they would be good to wait for the results of that brain study or not?
You know, you'd have to look at it like this. That's kind of illogical, because Burbacher's monkeys were presumably normal monkeys. We've heard testimony here that there was this subset of susceptible individuals who get regressive autism, everybody else from mercury, and everybody else just does fine with their vaccines. There is no logical reason to possibly conclude that the Burbacher monkeys represent a susceptible subpopulation that's likely to get regressive autism. So they wouldn't even be the right model to look at that.
What about the tribulin study on rats looking at neural inflammation? Are you saying that's a useless study then too?
I didn't say it's useless. I'm just saying it's uninformative about the question about whether thimerosal causes, thimerosal from vaccines causes autism.
Regressive autism.
Any kind of autism.
Thank you.
Respondent, any further questions for Dr. Brown?
I just have a follow-up question. Dr. Brown, I just want to clarify some questions Mr. William asked you about the series of Vodder papers.
Yeah.
He talked about the doses of the inorganic mercury that was administered to the monkeys in that study.
Yeah.
Could you discuss those doses and how they relate to the question at hand?
Sure. That was the point that I had tried to make, that if you look at that study that shows inorganic mercury deposition in the brain and microglial activation for whatever reason, that is due to the inorganic mercury. The inorganic mercury in our brain comes primarily from methylmercury, from seafood, from breastfeeding, from even chicken. So that study, if that study actually represented a model of autism, then we would have an awful lot of autism from breastfeeding, and we would have an awful lot of autism from seafood. So it can't possibly represent an appropriate model.
And was there, what was the significance, if any, to the findings that were in the calcarine sulcus cortex?
All right, yeah. That was one of the areas in the brain that was looked at by the Charleston and Botter studies. And that is a particular area of the brain that is a target area for mercury. So you certainly, when you give those kinds of doses of mercury, you're going to see effects in that particular area. It involves the visual pathways.
And did those papers actually discuss astrocyte death?
No, no. There was no. It did not actually show astrocyte death.
And I know you've discussed and said several times that those monkeys showed no clinical symptoms. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what does, accepting the results of the Votter study, what does this tell you about clinical findings you would expect to see with thimerosal-containing vaccines?
Well, I'm sure the Votter study data is valid. I'm sure it's a good study. It comes from a good lab, and I accept the results as were published. What it tells us is that if you give these very high doses, you get this neuroinflammation. They didn't show neuroinflammation. You get this microglial activation. We don't know what it means or what the significance of it is because the monkeys were clinically fine. All of us have microglial activation under some circumstances all the time. But if that process, once again, were to lead to autism, and inorganic mercury was the cause of autism, then it would be our major sources of inorganic mercury, which are breastfeeding and food and diet.
And what did these series of studies with adult macaques tell you about thimerosal-containing vaccines causing autism in infants?
Well, those studies didn't deal with autism to begin with, so the studies themselves really don't deal with autism. And therefore, there's really no conclusions you can reach about that.
Let's see. And another clarification, you were talking about, and I'm going to go back to the Burbacher paper, the doses of the 20 micrograms per kilogram administered to the monkeys over four different vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
What would a child have to weigh to receive 80 micrograms per kilogram of ethyl mercury over those first 6 months of
life? We did a little back of the envelope type of calculation at lunch. Turns out it's about, to get that amount from vaccine, a child would have to weigh 2.3 kilograms at 6 months. Rather unlikely scenario.
2.3 kilograms.
Four and a half pounds.
Convert it for those of us who are...
4.5 pounds.
4.5 pounds at 6 months.
If the mode of injury discussed today is inorganic mercury, why isn't this happening to people without thimerosal-containing vaccines?
That's the exact question I've been raising all day. Children today are getting, and all throughout time, have been getting methyl mercury converted to inorganic mercury at doses in excess of what they get from vaccines just from breastfeeding, not to speak of diet.
And if we assume that microglia continue to stay active solely because of the presence of inorganic mercury, what can we assume will happen because of this exposure to inorganic mercury from dietary sources in humans?
Well, this was demonstrated, of course, as a rather high-dose experiment. And, if indeed these very, very low doses of inorganic mercury from either breastfeeding or from vaccine would it cause microglial activation, then as individuals continue to take in methylmercury through their diet, their microglial activation would just continue to increase and increase and increase, and we would all have very high degrees of microglial activation.
And my last question, is there anything else you'd like to comment on today?
Oh, I think I've commented quite a bit. You're all probably quite tired of hearing from me.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Williams?
Nothing.
I have a couple of questions for you. You can't quite leave, Dr. Brent.
Please.
I want to take you back to the Burbacher article briefly.
Sure.
As I'm reading the article and hearing the testimony, the researchers there used equivalent doses of methyl and ethyl mercury.
That is correct.
One administered intramuscularly and the ethyl mercury, and the other administered orally.
That is correct.
And let me phrase this in terms first of lethal dose. That is, if we're talking lethal dose of ethyl mercury versus lethal dose of methyl mercury, are we talking the same amounts, or is there some rough equivalency that one measure of ethyl mercury is equivalent to one of methyl mercury?
The study that I could think of that addressed that was the 1985 study of Dr. Magos, where they gave equivalent doses of methyl and ethyl mercury. And they found that for the same dose, you actually get a bit more neurotoxicity from methyl mercury than from ethyl mercury, anatomically.
But you don't have any idea what the equivalency is.
It wasn't a huge difference. It was about, because they then gave, I think, about 20 or 30% higher of ethyl mercury than methyl mercury, and they found a similar amount of damage as they did in the lower dose of methyl mercury. So it's about a 20 or 30%. So methyl mercury is about 20 or 30% more neurotoxic than ethyl mercury in that study.
In terms of how much mercury ends up in the brain, this inorganic mercury, can you tell me the difference between the necessary dose of methyl mercury versus a dose of ethyl mercury? Is there any comparison?
Well,
I apologize for being inarticulate, but it's
better. No, I absolutely understand your question. If you look at the Burbacher study, you can see that the amount of mercury in the brain following thimerosal administration ends up being primarily inorganic mercury. And I think we looked at a number. It was over 10. You know, it was I think I saw a number of 16 or something like that, parts per billion. If you look at the what happens when you give the equivalent dose of methyl mercury, and I wonder if we could bring up the Burbacher methyl mercury slide. In fact, why don't we put them next to each other so you can see exactly the mercury concentrations that are achieved under both circumstances. Okay, so on the right you have thimerosal, and as you can see, the dashed line is the amount of inorganic mercury, and it's something a little over 10. And the ethyl mercury at its peak looks like 10, 20, something between 20 and 30 parts per billion, rapidly goes away. The methyl mercury at a similar dose gives the levels that you see here, maybe about 7 parts per billion of inorganic mercury. But on top of that, the organic mercury is up at about 100 parts per billion. So it is far, far in excess. A similar dose of methyl mercury gives you far, far more combined organic and inorganic mercury in the brain than you will get from ethyl mercury. And this is the best comparison I know.
And your testimony then is that organic methyl mercury will be converted to inorganic mercury, but albeit at a slower rate than the ethyl mercury on the right slide has already been converted to.
Well, to be scientifically precise, the methyl mercury, we know the methyl mercury is slowly converted to ethyl mercury to inorganic mercury. It is possible that not 100% of it will do that. Some of it may actually leave the brain. We don't know. What we do know is that the difference in the mercury concentrations between the dose at the beginning of the experiment all the way on the left, if you look at figure 4, and the and at the end of the experiment on day 28 on the right, are not significantly different from each other. So that would suggest that if any leaves the brain at all, it's a very small and non-detectable amount, and that which remains behind, yes, will be ultimately converted to inorganic mercury.
I think those are my questions. Questions from either side based on mine. Government? Questions from either side based on mine? Do either of my colleagues have any questions? Apparently not. Other questions?
I have one more.
Go ahead.
Dr. Brent, if Dr. Burbacher were to publish in the future findings of microglial activation in the infant monkeys that he studied, similar to the findings described in the Charleston and Botter papers, would that change your opinion here today?
No, it couldn't. I'm just testifying about inorganic mercury from any source, and because it's the same inorganic mercury. And so if there is microglial activation, that microglial activation can just as well come from, and more likely would come, from the much larger doses of methylmercury from breastfeeding and diet.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Williams? All right. Dr. Brent, you're excused.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your patience.
It's 3:15. Do you want to proceed with your next witness or take a mid-afternoon break? What's your preference? Government? I know it would be early to take a mid-afternoon break. I'm just trying to get a feel for where you anticipate things going today.
Could we take a brief break just because we have to switch counsel and write?
10 minutes.
I just turned to this resident and I said, what would you like to do? And she said, I'm done. So she's going to definitely want to take her break, but we have to do a little switching.
Okay. Anyway. How much time? 5 minutes, 10 minutes? What do you need?
5 minutes? Or would you rather take this afternoon break?
Alex?
I believe this witness will be fairly short on breath.
I'm sorry?
I believe this witness will be fairly short on breath.
If we would press you on how short is short.
But we're trying to decide whether to give you a long break now and then proceed straight through otherwise, or...
I understand it'll be about an hour, perhaps a little less. Would you like to take a wrap?
Let's just take 5 minutes now.